Good evening and welcome. My name is Meg Sparling. I'm the general editor of Red Cedar Review, MSU's literary magazine since 1963. In a long-standing tradition of bringing internationally known writers to the undergraduates of Michigan State University, tonight Red Cedar Review presents Diane Glancy. To help me introduce Ms. Glancy is Red Cedar Review's associate editor, Laura Tisdale. But first, I would like to invite you all to join Red Cedar Review and Diane downstairs in the Cyber Cafe after the reading. I would also like to warmly thank Professor Penn for his very generous support of this event. I would also like to thank WordCraft Circle of NA Writers, the English Department, the College of Arts and Letters, and the Provost for this event. Laura, I would like to thank for her hard work and dedication and determination, and Diane for her time and willingness. Because of her cooperation and generosity, Red Cedar Review will be featuring an interview with her in the next issue. So enjoy the evening, and please join us downstairs afterwards.
And I'm Laura Tisdale. I'm the associate editor of the Red Cedar Review, and it was my privilege to get to know Diane Glancy today. Diane is a professor at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. She's a hard person to introduce because she's, as a writer, she's covered so many genres. She's written poetry, many, many collections of poetry. She's written creative nonfiction essays. She's written plays. She's written novels. She's a teacher. She's a mother. To introduce every aspect of Diane would take all night. So what I'd like to share with you is something personal that I've learned from Diane today and in reading her work before she arrived. In writing and as being a writer, you struggle with claiming a heritage, with claiming a culture. And the first time I read Diane's work, I was struck by how it didn't sound Native American to me. There were parts of it that sounded Native American, but I was expecting more buffaloes, more arrows, more headdresses. I was very inexperienced with the Native American culture. And what Diane's work taught me is that heritage and culture isn't like a suit that you put on. It isn't a bag of images that you draw from and then voila, you have a poem or a play. Heritage is a negotiation. Culture is an action that you take. And just like any heritage, it's finding a spot. Heritage isn't a line of chairs that saves you a spot. It doesn't come ready for you. Heritage is about smearing voices. It's about smearing different lines and different plots to find a spot that your own voice can rest. And Diane's poetry shows that. Diane's writing shows that in a very unique way. She experiments with a lot of different voices, with a lot of different dialects, and that's what makes her work so valuable. And I hope that you can all find something personal in her reading tonight. So without further ado, Diane Glancy.
What a sharp introduction that was, Laura. Thank you so much. I also thank the Red Cedar Review and this university and Mr. Penn himself. I think what I'm going to talk about is a poetic rationale. Poetry is a profound art. It gets at what cannot be gotten at in any other way. It catches the elusive web of thought that connects in an abstract way. In a novel, The Man Who Heard the Land, I speak about the land, and it's also transferable to poetry, to the writing that we do. It got back to the land. The land was his work. He heard its unanswerable questions, its mysteries, its conflicts. He heard the force of its ties, its implications, its patterns and relationships. When he heard the land, he knew he was hearing the underlying principles that bound his life. They were there, almost inaudible, something like a heartbeat. So it is that heartbeat, that poetic rationale, that connects us all. I think in poetry, we create a world. We explore it and we confront it. And in that confrontation, we somehow change or ruin it. An example of that was recently when I was trying to write about my mother's love of photography. There came up a lot of confrontation. And so when I was trying to, I guess, ease it, I found the opposite happened. Photographs. Those little truth serums, those little preachers that do not lie. They line up in the album like a firing squad. The evidence I have of my mother's life is the photograph albums I inherited, took rather, from her closet shelf. Most of the photographs are family gatherings, cousins and aunts and uncles at July 4th picnics, my brother and I holding our Easter baskets. Then the grandparents disappear. My father, one by one, others are not there. Slowly, the new generation appears. In my mother's photographs, we line up as if clothes hanging in a closet, as if the 39 Dakota hanged after the 1864 uprising in Mankato, Minnesota. We were her marionettes. She moved us with the strings of her camera. Looking at her photograph albums, I knew my mother had dreams she never realized. Her camera was her war against the non-documentation from which she came, except maybe the itinerant photographer who came by the farm like a god clothed in his box. Her philosophy of photography, line them up and shoot. She was the god of marionettes. Her principles were placement, light, standing still, and silence. Her photographs hold me with their strings. I don't own a camera. I return to the photographs like a piano practice piece. I look at the photo of me wearing a corsage, my hair curled, my hands in the white frost of the keys. Her world fell upon me like snow. I could not walk in it. My identity was a hand pushing me back. My identity was a pose, a representation of what I was, a fig leaf, an animal skin, the shedding of blood, mainly hers, to clothe me. My father shed blood too, in the stockyards where he worked. The cattle were driven up a ramp to the slaughter room, their throats slit. They were pulled upside down over a trough where their blood drained. They were cut into sections, their parts carted down the hall. In the same way, I entered her album and came out dressed. If my mother's photographs hang in her album like bodies from a gallows, it's because the past was death to whatever stood there. Yet she kept the family frozen in her photographs. They are magic. They are acoustics. They are the soldiers who shoot and the ones who die. So that creating a world and that deconstructing it at the same time. I'm also always thinking of theory. How do you explain what you do? And I wrote down a re-deconstructuring. And I have no idea what that means, but that is the poetic rationale that confronts and tears apart. Poetry is the ruins of a concrete structure. It's a primal force, a structure beneath the structure we see. When I was in Bemidji recently, I saw Paul Bunyan and his blue ox. I'm sure you all know that image of the tall lumberjack and his blue ox. And I was beginning, well, no, it was beginning, I guess, to reach me. And I already started some notes. I think if you want to write, you need to take notes. You all know that. And I was trying to explain the blue that the ox is, a dyed Easter egg taken too soon from the bowl. Ghost blue. Garish glare off the frozen lake. Babe the ox is almost transparent. You could see the clouds floating beneath his hide, two moons rolling on the moraine of his back. And by the way, the lumberjacks invented Babe because of the fear of the lumber camps. There was danger, the saws, the falling trees. And so they created this myth of a man so strong that he could not be hurt by any of it. And yet, in the confrontation with the idea and the release that is in it, there was the saw of words, the falling tree, and the danger of the possibility of being cut. So I think that's what I mean in bringing together words and in somehow the interactive tearing apart of them. And some of my other problems also with writing poetry, I'm from a culture in which, part of a culture in which oral tradition is very important. You tell a story or you don't say anything. You have to make your words count. And yet at the same time, I know that poetry moves in a very abstract way. So how do you walk in both worlds? Because often contemporary poetry resists story, in other words. So often you read something and you say, now exactly what has happened here? I also think that the poetic rationale is a principle that transcends genres and becomes other genres. And I find that very often in my writing. I'm going to read a little bit more poetry, and then I want to move on to the novel. As I said, my father worked in the stockyards all his life, and I had to reconcile the brutality of that, the smell that was in his car every night as he came home. And sometimes even on Saturdays, I would go down to the stockyards with him. This first poem is called Crow Standing Res. We played stockyards with our cardboard boxes, making cattle pens in the backyard. Drovers came with herds, then cattle cars on rails, these river bottoms at the confluence of the Missouri and Kaw. The flood we washed over the stockyards with our backyard hose, the puddles we let dry. Then the carts of tails and intestines, carts of tongues, making grooves on the wood floor of the packing house and the raven black knot of the heart. It was in Kansas City where my father had come north for work during the Depression. That was always the far north, Kansas City, Missouri. So my life was divided between the stockyards and Sunday school on Sunday. They handed out Bible verses like oars. It has an epigraph. These are the beasts you shall eat, the ox, the sheep, the fallow deer, the wild goat, the pygarg, Deuteronomy 14, 4 to 6. The pygarg was a bison, or an antelope, they said, whatever they could think of at any given moment. We walked the animals up the ramp where God, with a crimson underlining in his robe, opened a nostril and shot lightning out. The clouds were white as butcher paper. The rain fell as darkened knives. Christ in the tomb wore butcher paper as internment cloth when he traveled to the underworld to gather the slaughtered animals who walked to the men with knives. This shipwrecked sail of butcher paper glazed with sleet on the ocean, does snow fall there? For dinner on the tossing ship, here's what's for. A woman in a blue dress slicing the ship's log on a table, beating it with a meat cleaver, the axe, the sharpened knife, the pages, not a napkin on her lap. In The Migration of the Negro, number 1, by Jacob Lawrence, The Phillips Collection, Washington, D.C. The woman is slicing a slab of bacon, but it looks like a book. A boy stands by the table, his tongue against the tablecloth. Now my father is standing over the table, cutting a slab of bacon, his head bowed so low it looks like there is nothing on his shoulders, but my father is cutting a book. Outside there is snow covering the yard and trees like butcher paper. I hear the shovel on the walk, the thruck of it into the snow, lifting, tossing it to the side, the snow jumping from the shovel as if children in their trunks at a wading pool, the swirl of blue cold against the window. The house has curtains of butcher paper. The tables are troughs for blood from throats when hoisted with chains upside down like apostles, fiery angels cut loose. This, by the way, is called the Stockyards series. This is a few poems in a group called Remuda, which is a group of horses. Rapture. On the edge of town, my father in the stockyards drove cattle up the ramp. I could hear the feedlots and the cattle pens. I could hear the Remuda. The street near our house climbed a hill where a convent bell cut the neighborhood with its butcher knife. The sun stepped its hissing foot into puddles like tanks steaming hair off hide. Sometimes I put my fingers in and out my ears to trill the screech of locust as summer slipped into the closet like a moth. then old houses huddled like women holding buffalo scrapers. The first snow traveled over the plains on clouds heavy as cattle cars. Vaqueros rode the wind to the west, their lariats the leaves that fell. I thought of Christ in the convent sacrificed like cattle when the sky unloaded its burden of sun at vespers, then locust shells hanged empty on the bark as if Christ stepped from his cross, cracked the wafer sky, thin and transparent as dusk. Processional. The cattle go up the ramp, dragging their crosses. Their voices are Gregorian chants rising to the blue sky, the cold clouds. Their eyes are wide and white. The cows are on flame. They will go wild into heaven, where places are set in rippling tents, with tables and folding chairs and placards with their names. A fish will be tied on their heads. They will hold corn in their mouths. It is faith, then, that comes to elevate the dead. I go on a long time, but enough of the stockyards is enough. I'll read one more. Crucifixion. My father ran the freight elevator in the stockyards. Through the Depression, he moved up through departments, breaking strike lines, loading trucks. One night, a car stopped in front of our house before moving on. I remember my father in the dark at the front window, but the car drove off and another house was bombed. The packing house was brutal, a death on the cross. But my father made it to plant superintendent and sat on the front porch after his hernia operation, resting from his holy work, the cattle crowned with thorns, the hogs crucified. I've been writing now on the hog barns that I pass as I drive from Minnesota down to Kansas City to see my family. Again, the poetic rationale transferred to fiction. I want to read a little bit from a novel just out, The Mask Maker. And I assume one of the readers that approved of it is in this room. That's what I've heard anyway, so thank you. You know who you are. This book is built upon the premise, at one time the Great Spirit made masks, and after that he had to make people to go with them. I'm going to give what is called a drive-through reading. In other words, I'm just going to pick passages throughout the book. It's written from my many years of experience in Oklahoma. I taught poetry, and Edith does masks. Edith was a mask maker. She traveled for the Arts Council of Oklahoma. She felt she was an artist in a place without art, a misfit in a practical world. But art was truth. It was revenge. It was masks that held Edith on the road. She had a car full of them. The masks told a story, but Edith hated words, wobblers. That's what they were, especially in the mouth of Bill Lewis, her former husband. Edith worked presenting masks to a world that did not want them. What was she doing on the road, traveling between schools by herself? Maybe the mask kept her from being blown out like the last of the sons she followed. Edith thought about the masks as she traveled. They were sticky as love, sticky as paint, not quite dry, like glue that held her to her former husband. Always back to him. It was a world full of roads that dropped off the earth at the edge of town. Then she was on her own, in her nothingness, without Bill Lewis. The edge of town was Pawnee, Oklahoma, a remote place by some railroad tracks no one knew about. Had she ever looked at it without a mask? Had she ever looked at herself? Edith was a mask maker. She went to schools and presented her masks. She had the students make masks. Edith was the queen of masks, except Indians didn't have a queen. If they did, she would be queen of the Indians, that's what. But what would an Indian queen do? She would have a throne. No, thrones. They would be the hills of Oklahoma where they cropped up. She would have subjects. They would be her masks. Yes, there were princesses. Indian princesses were all over the place, but why was there no queen? One queen could not rule the different tribes anyway. No, there would have to be as many queens as there were different tribes, which differed vastly in differing bands within those different tribes. But Edith decided to ignore that fact. She would be queen of Indians. She would be the mask maker. Every Sunday, Edith opened her map to find the Oklahoma town where she was headed for the week. She left her two boys, Joseph and Benjamin, ages 17 and 14, with Maybelle, her former mother-in-law. She left Bill Lewis, her former husband. She left a friend, Bill Bixel, but she called him Bix. One Bill was enough. Edith couldn't remember when she made the first mask. There had been the one in school, first or second grade. The children had made masks. The teacher made one. They hung them on a line. She had wanted to put her name on the teacher's mask. How had the teacher made it? Why had the teacher put her mask on the line with the children's mask, comparing hers to theirs, knowing hers would outshine them? It was a lesson in something the children couldn't do, making a mask as lovely as the teacher's. It taught them failure. Was it just now Edith felt anger at that memory? Maybe the teacher hadn't intended to show she could make a better mask, but what else could the children think? It seemed to Edith the teacher held up something out of Edith's reach, showed her authority. Maybe the teacher was just wanting acceptance from the children. Sure. Years later, Edith Lewis worked with masks. She traveled to schools to show students how to make masks. She never took her good mask, the ones that would be better than theirs, showing them what she could do that they couldn't. She also had an Indian heritage. Maybe she just got asked to schools because she filled a quota. But what did that heritage mean to her? Land? The land was flat and covered with low brush. The land was fierce with heat and wind. It hurt her eyes to look at it. What could she say of the Great Plains through Oklahoma, where she lived? It had holes for eyes, for nose. Maybe it was the idea of land instead of the land itself. Every year, the Arts Council said it might be the last year for the visiting writer, the visiting artist program. There weren't funds for the program to continue, but every year, Edith faced teachers at the artist showcase. She wanted her masks recognized for what they were, but what were they? They were her art, which no one knew. Edith had to make them known. At the spring showcase every year, was it 8 years now, Edith talked about her mask. The teachers had to understand what she did. If they signed her up to visit their schools, she would have work through the next year again, if only to pay her bills, if only to make Bill not laugh, though he would. Edith thought of the reasons for making masks. She called her program Mask Attack, with the subtitle, I Couldn't Face Without a Mask. What does that mean? Benjamin, her son, had asked. Something will come, she answered. If the students could understand a mask, Edith said to the teachers at the showcase, they could understand abstract thought. They could reason on different levels. They could understand something beneath another surface. Mask making was a tool transferable to other disciplines. What was she saying? Edith thought, but it didn't matter. They were buying it. In the end, she knew the faces under the mask of interest the teachers wore. You give us time to grade papers, make lessons plans, keep the students occupied for a while. One day, Principal Potiphar came into the art room before the students arrived. And if I wanted to make a mask, he asked, I'd hand you a paper bag. What then? It doesn't happen all at once. You have to attend classes. Think of a face for your mask. Call it from its hiding place with your paints. What kind of a mask do you think I'd make, he asked. One you think that you should make, but you have to put that pattern aside, work harder. What part of yourself do you want to hide? That's where you start a mask. Work with shape until you feel that alignment, until your mask lines up with something you feel. That's the way it starts to work, in the energy that gets trapped between the face and the mask it wears. Sometimes when she closed her eyes at night, Edith saw masks. They waited to come into her sleep. Where were the masks when she was awake, when she was in front of a class? Was she influencing them? Was she their dreams? Things were not always as they were seen. And what did they say to her sleep? Were they masks she would later make? Did they hunt her to use her to bring them from the dark into the light? Were they real and she was the mask? At night, Edith thought of her friend Bix. Once Laura, his clerk in the Pawnee Hardware, who ordered supplies, shifted columns in the catalog somehow. It was Bix who opened the box of snowblowers, ice choppers, snow shovels, and roof rakes. It was the roof rakes that people remembered. The thought of snow piles so high on a roof that it needed to be pulled off with a rake on the end of a 30-foot handle was a thought they needed in Pawnee. In summer, when the temperatures were over 100 for several weeks, Bix asked Laura if she minded if he put the roof rakes in the window of his hardware before he shipped them back. That was the difference between Bix and Bill Lewis. If it was Edith's mistake, Bill would have displayed the roof rakes without asking. Bill could act like the rakes were his mistake and joke about them, but Bix had the hardware behind him. Bill had nothing covering him. Bill, it was always Bill. Now he had married Joelle Thomas. What? Edith heard it from Maybelle, her former mother-in-law. Married? Yes, Benjamin agreed, it was true. Joseph and his girlfriend had stood with them. Suddenly, part of Edith's life was gone. She got in her car, drove down the red dirt roads without her mask in the back seat, drove down the road she and Bill had covered. She could not get Bill Lewis back. Had she wanted him back? Well, now Edith could marry Bill Bixel. She could learn to trust a man, sure. The dirt and pebbles pinged under the car like a hailstorm until she hit paved road on the way back to her house on Nash and 4th. Edith was walking down the street in Pawnee, finishing errands before she left the next day, when she saw Bill and Joelle Lewis walking toward her. They were with Joseph, Benjamin, and Maybelle. Going to Maylilly's for supper, Bill said, how are you? Fine, and you, Benjamin? Hello, Edith said, as if she were a stag or a yak or an Arctic polar bear or a panther or the big-footed boy from Pawnee Bill's Wild West intergalactic show. She wanted outer space. Where could she go? At least they didn't ask her to join them. Get her out of here. She was never coming back to Pawnee. Nice seeing you, yes. Enjoy your supper. Trip on the step. Choke on a chicken bone. She was going to have to find some other place to live. In her mask, Edith saw the earth was a shiny ball that kept its door shut so she could fly its hot, curved surface as it went around the awful, awesome universe. In a mask, Edith saw the earth itself was a mask. A mask was an understatement. A mask was the bit in a horse's mouth. A mask was the open seam of the world. A mask was the seam of the world. There had always been masks. They were a part of the civilization. They had a history. Masks had transformed Edith. They could drive across the prairie. She could drive across the prairie because of masks. She could walk into classrooms because of masks. She could face herself because of masks. I like to experiment with language. This, I guess, is a short story. It's called A Later Game of Marbles. And it begins with an Aboriginal myth. Once the earth and the sky were one. There was no room to stand, no light to see. Everyone crawled around in darkness. A flock of birds thought they could lift the sky. They flew up into the dark. The sky split and revealed the sun. That's why birds are first to greet the dawn. This was a story I had found in Australia. And also in Australia, they have dot paintings. I don't know if you've seen them. They do a landscape with just a series of dots. And I thought, could I write that way? So this story, which I know you can't see, there's a period that follows almost every three or four words. And it begins, the crows cawed. And there's a period. Just before, period. Dawn, period. And if I kept reading the little blocks of sentence, it would get probably fairly irritating. So I'm just going to read it. The crows cawed just before dawn. He heard them, he thought, at first light. But later he knew it was earlier, before he woke, when the dream givers were still shooting marbles. Click, click, He heard them as he woke. The dream givers came early when he first entered the dark sky of sleep. Their faces swirled red and black with flames, corkscrews, Popeyes, Joseph coats, Lutzes, oxbloods. They walked without sound, only their game made noise. They had to get into his head to keep his thoughts on earth, otherwise he would slip forever away from the darkness into the true dark. Maybe the crows slit the dark to let in the waking. He knew the crows spoke to him. He tried to listen, past the hush of the dream givers, who knew he was awake now, a change in his breathing or quick movement that did not belong to sleep. He rubbed his head and the sleep from his eyes. The dawn was blue as the pocket shirt where the denim had not faded. He picked up the shirt from the chair, got dressed. The dream givers were surely gone. Now they'd done their work, turning the darkness inside out, spilling him to the floor, like chaff from a pocket, or pants cuff, or marbles from a table. The sun was over the edge of the cabin. What kept him here? Though the crows had done their work, he could still hear them caw. They were darkness to the light, as moon was light to the dark. His neck ached from sleep. His head felt heavy, damp as bacon. He would go through the day, his heart wrapped in baling wire. He wanted to be with the ancestors. He remembered his great-grandfather rolling marbles in his hand. That's what drinking did eventually, stopped the dreams, so he could cross to the other world. Maybe his dog would be waiting for him. There, yes, the dreams were the animals of nature. He drank from a bottle of whiskey, ate a stale piece of fry bread. He remembered following his grandma to the chicken coop. The hens cackled, the fire just lit from kindling, or a game of marbles. He remembered his grandma's patched dress, her large shoes, their tongues all parched, dust on them like something he was supposed to remember but kept getting away from. He felt the moon, half light, half dark, the moon also light for the dream givers playing ringer. He thought he heard hens cackling. No, that was the dream giver with orbs and shooters painted on his forehead. Maybe the crows were fragments of the blackness broken because of the light. The earth was his grandmother, unable to take care of him anymore because she was sick. Now he followed her, not even knowing how to turn for the sun's warmth on both sides. It was the day that was hard. Someday he'd escape the earth, its bright light into dark. Someday he'd sleep and not return. He'd pass from ordinary dark into true dark that shut out the earth. The dream givers could throw as many dreams at him as they wanted. They could hit his head until it jumped like a sack full of agates. He wouldn't come back, no, he'd be gone. There's nothing they, nor the crows, nor anyone could do. More than ever now, when he started his old truck, he wanted the night, when the moon followed the earth. What bothered him? The wife he'd not been able to keep? Even the animal chose to leave. No, the dog had been made to leave. He remembered something kicking. Was it his leg or what? Sometimes the crows yelped like a hurt dog. Maybe the groaning was from his own throat. When he got to work, he'd be late, in trouble again. He didn't want to think about it. He remembered climbing the hill behind his grandpa's farm, the clumps of birches between the narrow fields, the creek that dried in summer. The rocks from the sweat lodge spoke to him. Sometimes in his stupor, he tried to turn to light, but too much had happened. Yes, yet there was something in him that resisted true darkness, something that sent the dream givers. Maybe that was the nature of the landscape inside his head. He had in himself the struggle of dark and light. Maybe he had to learn to face both, but where did they come from? Was the creator a trickster? Sometimes the crows seemed to laugh. Or was the creator a giving spirit who sent light, not the ordinary glare that men brought into their lives by their own efforts and had to live with, no, but the true light? Did he have to choose between the possibilities? Would he always roll like marbles, spinning, changing places on the floor? All right then, it was light for the moment he'd face the creator's light But someday he'd be through. Then he could follow the ancestors. He'd go back to his grandpa's place. He'd hear him call him Pee-wee again. He'd climb the hill behind the sweat lodge. Yes, he'd see the clouds overhead. It was only a click up there to the sky. I want to end with a piece on words, because language is one of our most important possessions. It's the word, I heard it in my sleep, the word that makes things work. The stars glass the way ahead. I look into the darkness. Before there was anything, there was word. But it stayed inside the spirit for a while, until that first creation point, that explosion that was to become form. The word was so very fine, I suppose you would call it mind. It was beyond human conception. The first little bunch of stuff in the spirit was so small, it was mind word, too fine to be energy or gross body, just this little something. It was the first indication that something would come. It rolled around in the great spirit's mouth like a tooth. It was the spirit's way of saying, let there be. The spirit was everywhere, and this little pet was in the bosom of the spirit, and it began to roam, up and out the mouth, boom. And the word became words, and they were spirit. Nobody has seen spirit, nobody has seen word, but that's the way it was. The word kept subdividing. It was so close to spirit, it was just a part of it. The word kept dividing into words and wouldn't stop. After a while, the words got so complicated, they became a lot of separate things. So at that point, the unifying was the separator. The little speck that was words broken off from word, it started thinking for itself. It decided to think it was spirit. The words rebelled. They got a big head looking at everything they had done. The words got themselves together and thought they would be God, and they got far enough out of his house that they thought they were the house builder himself. Well, you can imagine all those words running around, words of healing, words of laughter, words of hurt. All right, I guess that's enough. Thank you. Oh, yes.
I'm sorry. I'll just ask it now because I've heard you talk about it, so it's interesting enough that I think everyone would be interested in it. Today, Diane was speaking in a graduate class, and she was, what was most interesting to me was you were talking about balancing Christianity with being a Native American at the same time. And to me, that seems like such a contradiction. And you handle it very well in your poetry. How do you do that? Like, where did you personally find a balance in your beliefs?
That's been very difficult for me. I'm from the Bible Belt, and I would say 60% of the Cherokee are born-again Christian, you know, that kind of religion that you hear about and generally sends shivers up your backbone. But nonetheless, I mean, this whole world is full of contradiction and things that simply do not fit. I've often said it feels like I have feet on the end of my legs, each one going the opposite way. And you know how hard it is to walk like that. And so it's not only been Christianity and Native heritage, of which I'm only a part, but it's many other things too. I mean, how do you be a writer and a mother? How do you teach and write? There are things that are going out the opposite way. I mean, give me something easy. I've never yet quite found anything. So again, it was somehow holding together the disparate parts. It's one of my favorite subjects, actually. You get in real trouble talking about Christianity, especially at Native conferences, which I have done in the past. I will say that the major religion of the Native American is Christianity, but in its many different denominations. You know, up in the north where I live now, it's Catholic, Lutheran. Where I'm from in the south, it's more of the evangelical Baptist, you know, that sort of Pentecostal church, actually. But the way I think I've accepted Christianity is that it is based upon the word. God spoke the world into being, the power of words, the power of story. I see my colleague here with a smile on his face. Or is that a smirk, sir? And I don't know what else to say. It's work. So many people say, how can you believe that stuff? And yet it's been a structure for my life. I mean, I just always found that life was harder than what I was able to deal with. I raised two children on my own. I faced that hard economic wall of the world. I don't think I could have done all that on my own upon ceremony. I needed another power, and I always felt it coming through Christ, through the ancestors, through my father, who's been dead almost 30 years. I often feel him with me. That's another reason I love to drive on the road at night. That you're around such a crowd, you know, when you're alone on the road at night. So, what a great question. And I don't know the answer, you know. I mean, how do you put your contradictions together? Isn't that the work we're going to do all our lives? It just gets worse. I will tell that to the students right now. I've heard students say, oh, I can't wait to get out of college. You know, it'll be easier. It only gets harder. Now, do I have any other good news for you? But it is also glorious. Where did that word come from? I mean, there's, you finally get to where you really like the struggle. You like the war. You love to be on your war horse. I don't know. There's an invigoration that comes from it. There's a lot of things worth fighting for. So we live in a very narrow and sick world, I would say, in a way. Remember what I told you earlier today? You're going to be in trouble no matter what you do, so you might as well make it something that counts. You might as well make it something that you believe in, and then just go forth to battle. So, another question.
Sorry. That sparked another question to me. You're only partly American, mm-hmm. for lots of other things.
Right.
What made you decide how much authority you were going to give yourself? Mm-hmm. Where did you draw the line that it wasn't part of you anymore, or you couldn't use that voice, or you just didn't have the word?
I think it's still all a part of me. As I talked earlier, being born between so many cultures and not knowing anything about the voice that was ignored or pushed aside. I told you earlier that my mother was German and English. She was very outgoing, and she kind of dominated, I would say, and my brother and I and my father were dark and kind of morose and quiet and always sat on the in the back, and my father's family was even farther away, not much appreciated. But there was something that I always loved when I went to visit them. There was a lot of silence, but there was something very important in that silence. And furthermore, when you write, it dictates to you what you're going to say, you know, whatever comes from within, wherever writing comes from. You have your ideas, it matches the rhythms from which you speak, and when they meet together on the page, you finally feel that road that you are going somewhere. There's pavement underneath you. My mother used to say to me, why don't you ever write about the white heritage? And I did do a book called The Only Piece of Furniture in the House. It's about a young white woman who's very close to her mother. And if you know anything about writing short stories, you have to ask yourself, what's the worst thing that can happen to your character? Well, she had to be separated from her mother, this close relationship. So she met a soldier, they moved to an army barracks, and she, the girl, had to become the only piece of furniture in the house. And as I read it later, I thought, that's about the loss of Native heritage. That's about the loss of language. That was the mother, you know, that. So no matter what you write or whatever form that it's in, it's those same themes that come over and over. The importance of words, the making of something from nothing, the anger, the loss, the reconstruction, the longing for what you will have to live without the rest of your life. That's another line out of something I have written. I don't know, I just write the same thing over and over, you know. Just different characters, I guess, different ways of saying. There was another question. I thought I saw somebody else's hand. Yes?
Something that you said about the difficulty of keeping simplicity and go out and feel things that are more than running along.
I don't know, life is always overwhelming, I think. I think, again, it's the word. I heard it in my sleep, that last piece I read. You know, just the the companion of the voice, the companion of storytelling. Often when I travel, I listen to a book on tape, or if I'm working in my motel room, wherever I am, I sometimes record my voice if I'm working on a piece, and just, I don't know, just the simplicity of the voice and the story, the plain story that somehow breaks through to the meaning that you have within you. And it's hard, especially in academia, the clutter of committee meetings, the clutter of, it just keeps getting worse, doesn't it? There's just more red tape, more committees, more subcommittees, more steering committees. If I go through one more committee, I don't know what I will do. It's hard, I guess, but again, language, the reality of language, it is its own being. You always have questions.
Well, I've been interested in listening to you today because you keep talking about contradictions, and yet you and I disagree on some things. It seems to me you manage to keep contradictions in check in your writing. And it comes through in the poetry that you're actually asking these questions. And you said this afternoon in Marshall Aldrich's class that poetry asks questions, maybe prose gives answers, and my part of mine said, no, prose asks questions too. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more, since books like Flame and Breath, some of your books seem like a long time ago, because you've written so many. You use a lot of the short sections, you use the aboriginal dots.
Right.
And there's one piece you read. Do you feel that the structure?
I'm Oprah.
Hey, Phil.
Hi, Marcia.
Yes, I was just going to say that. Thank you. Yes, Marcia, that's a good point. Stand up and turn around. Why don't you?
I can't do this twice. That took a lot of energy, Marcia. I was talking about the way she said this afternoon the poetry asks questions, and I was responding when she said it that prose asks questions too. And while she's talked about the contradictions that are in her poetry, and I think she handles those contradictions well in the poems themselves, I wondered if there wasn't something in the structure of the prose that you do, even in the Trail of Tears novel, even in Pushing the Bear, to kind of get all the titles right, where you use voices, but those voices tend to be, they tend to interact as in the same way that the sections of Claiming Breath do, in short sections. And here you are reading us a piece that has dots in it. And I wondered if part of your attempt to control contradictions was in the actual formal and visible and tactile structure of the work you do.
Yes,
is that
it
a
is.
Reasonable question? That's a different question than what I was trying to ask, Marcia, but that's the best I can
and
do.
And you just got my answer, yes.
Thank you.
That was a wonderful question and answer right there. Yes. Yes, I have a 2-year-old grandchild, and he's always, no is his favorite word. Everything I say is no. And finally one day when I left to drive back to Minnesota, quickly before he could answer, I said to him, Joseph, the answer is yes, and closed the door and ran to the car and drove off. Here I am arguing with a 2-year-old. So yes is still the best answer. That's the answer to the whole universe, yes. I don't know, I guess that's enough. Silence is speaking now, just a minute. Okay, it had to have its place too. Thank you.